20 of FemLonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we're continuing our conversation around inclusive immigration. We'll chat with KJ about his own personal lived experience as an international student and as integrating into the workforce. There's lots in here. It's a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I'd also love to hear if you like this format of having multiple episodes on a similar topic but from a different lens. So please feel free to reach out about that. And without further ado, let's get into the conversation. KJ, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you. And to kick us off, I would actually love if you would just introduce yourself.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I am a huge fan of the podcast. I do a lot of driving and I download like a few episodes as I go. And it's always good to, you know, be educated and hear your perspective. So I really do enjoy that. But without further ado, I'm KJ. The full government name is Kyodnispa Kanyusteed. I was born and raised on the beautiful islands of Bermuda. I've been living and growing. This is a new thing I like to say now, is in New Brunswick for the past 5 years now. I'm a lover of policy. I'm a lover of diversity and inclusion. And I believe that the two, you know, can, you know, benefit each other very well. And I'm also the executive director of the New Brunswick Student Alliance, which is the largest student one of the largest student organizations within the province, and, you know, one of the major student advocates within the region of the Maritimes.
Amazing. And listeners who have been following will recognize that name, the New Brunswick Student Alliance. That is also where I had my advocacy start. And KJ, I think that's where we officially met a few years back.
Correct. Yeah.
And yes, you're now at the helm. So I'm excited to see what you'll do there. And I'm actually really excited again to see how your perspective, because it is different from what the recent past executive directors have been. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how you kind of morph the role based on your background as well.
Yeah, like I'm really excited for it. You know, I am a former student leader. I was on the board of the organization. So I feel like I have like an inside scoop. And it's really good. We just recently finished our Maritime Student Congress, and the passion and the desire of these student leaders who want to, you know, make a difference within their provinces is like so inspiring. And it's I feel like I'm getting a shock to my system. And, you know, it brings me into this conversation, you know, around, you know, immigration and, you know, newcomers and diversity and inclusion. And it's like these students want to like dive right in and say like, how can our student union, you know, be involved in these conversations? So it's like, it's full circle for me, and it's I'm looking forward for the next 2 years.
Amazing. So yeah, we'll jump into that journey a little bit more as well. As you mentioned right off the top, you're a fan of the podcast, and we appreciate so much your support. And actually, a great way to kick this discussion off, a few weeks back now, on our FemLonk Instagram page, I put up a question, like, what does inclusive immigration mean to you? And you actually responded saying the ideal immigration model looks at people as humans, not solely as a workforce. And that for me was like exactly what I was thinking, exactly what I was going for as well. So I love that. And I'd love to, again, hear a bit more about your personal journey and how maybe that quote or how kind of the perspective of inclusion has impacted your personal journey.
Yeah. So my journey, as I said, you know, started in the islands of Bermuda. So Bermuda is a small group of islands in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The closest landmass to us is around 750 miles. So we're pretty isolated. And so, like, that's where my journey started. I've always loved policy. I remember when I was in primary school, I would build my own little cabinet with people I knew. And I would, you know, always talk about it. But then, so I understood policy very well. I was involved with different organizations within the island surrounding, like, youth parliament and really, really looking into, like, how can we empower youth. So like that was like my foundation for wanting to get involved and really try to be a voice for individuals. And then during the time, you know, I struggled with mental health, and, you know, I had barriers of being a part of the LGBT community within an island that really doesn't accept individuals who are part of the community. So I had that internal struggle as well, and trying to figure out a way of how do I see myself, you know, living in an island that I love so much, because, you know, I love my island. I'm a big national pride person. So like I had all these internal struggles going on, and then this led me to one of my main reasons why I left Bermuda, and I wanted to push to get my education. I remember my 18th birthday, I blew up my candles, and I was like, I gotta figure out a way to leave. I gotta figure out a way to be able to, you know, educate myself and be able to sustain myself, and I wanted to be free. So, you know, we always say education is a big equalizer. So I had the opportunity to fly to St. John, New Brunswick, and I fell in love with the city. You know, I always say that St. John is one of the loves of my life. and so like that really, you know, wanted me to stay in New Brunswick. And then I started to get comfortable within the city. And, you know, I attended the University of New Brunswick on the St. John campus. And then I started to realize that the decisions that were being made about me were made by people who didn't look like me. And I remember I was sitting with a group of international friends, and then we were talking about everything that was happening within our university, that happening within the city. And we were just saying, like, why isn't no one doing anything? And someone made the joke. I was like, well, why don't you do it? And then I was just like, nah, I wouldn't do that. And then I dive right into it, and I've, you know, been trying to shake up this system ever since. So that's my journey.
That's amazing. A lot to unpack there, a lot I'd like to follow up with. First, I love that you say St. John is one of the loves of your life. So I grew up in St. John, most of my family still lives there. Mm-hmm. But as I was growing up, you know, it was... Well, I will say St. John, particularly Uptown, has had a real transformation in the last probably mm-hmm. 5-ish years. But I remember this community that honestly, like, it was a really sad community when I was growing mm-hmm. up there. Like, that's how I felt about it. And now mm-hmm. to see the revitalization and to see, like, amazing folks like you coming and loving St. John, like, it has given me such a new appreciation for just how beautiful and amazing the community is. So thank you for that.
And then, no problem. And it started like I came into St. John when, you know, it was like on the verge of, you know, where it's at now, and I still loved it. And then it takes me to like a larger thing when I look at the whole province. We always say, oh, New Brunswick is a have-not province, and I am constantly talking about how much I love New Brunswick, and everyone just tells me to shut up sometimes, but I'm just saying the beautifulness and the diversity within the province, as limited as it may be, I just see the potential and the beauty within the province. But
absolutely.
So
you did highlight a few challenges, particularly when you arrived in Canada and St. John, and recognized that a lot of the folks having these conversations about things that directly impacted you didn't look like you, were probably a lot older, probably not in the LGBT community. Would you mind highlighting maybe some other challenges, even like honestly the like minute like getting a visa to come to Canada, like things like that you experienced?
No problem. So I'll say my challenges were broken up into three things. One, we don't respect intersectionality when it comes to people. But when it comes to our newcomers that come in, we have like this stereotype or this perceived notion, especially when it comes to international students, that the only reason why international students are here, they have to be well off, or they have a sense of privilege. And, you know, that already creates a barrier there. So my challenges were, you know, my intersectionality and, you know, constantly having to, you know, break down these stereotypes connected to me because I wasn't Canadian. So like that's something that really, you know, to this day really impacts me. But, you know, as an 18-year-old who was still trying to figure it out, that really hurt me, and that really, you know, really had a toll on my mental health and trying to figure out a way to, you know, be productive here in the province. And then I would say lack of diversity. I will go and be the only person of color there. And it'll be hard. It's hard to go from, like, Bermuda has diversity, and, you know, I never felt like I was an other, to, you know, moving to becoming that other, you know, walking down the street and having people look at you, or, you know, walking down the street and having people cross the street from you. So, like, these things, you know, they take a toll. And then I guess my last thing is, like, lack of empathy for international students. And that's, you know, coming from, you know, from the institution level, that's coming from the government level, and that's coming from, you know, we as a community, we don't embrace our international students, and we only look at them as international students, not students who are leaving their countries and moving to a new place and dealing with all of these new changing things. So I would say that those were my challenges. Those three.
So absolutely. And I think you make such a, like, you highlight such a key piece of importance that even on university communities, or campuses rather. So I, of course, was at UNB Fredericton. Honestly, I don't think I had real meaningful interactions and dialogues with international students until I was in a position of leadership. Mm-hmm. And it was only then that I realized, again, some of the major barriers and challenges, whether it was, like, again, just being in a totally different community without your support networks, or, like, again, when we started, we were advocating for international student healthcare, like, mm-hmm. and that was one that kind of boggled my mind, because, you know, when you think about healthcare in Canada, it is something that we take for granted as a universal access point. Not all healthcare, obviously, like, there still needs to be a lot done with mental health and mm-hmm. prescription drugs and things like that, but we take it for granted that we can access healthcare. And so being in a totally different country and something happening and being just having that level of anxiety in addition yeah. to the other anxieties that any person would face in a new country, in a new community, like, it was little things like that that I kind of was like, oh my god, guys, like, let's get our shit together here.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Like, you know, like, when it comes to, like, the international healthcare, that is a huge thing. We live our lives being like, okay, we're good, we're okay. But that moment that something happens, the rippling effects of that, of how you will feel, it's as you say, it's something that we take for granted. And it's, you know, that's one thing that when I was involved with MBSA, I remember the day when we found out that we got international healthcare. I literally immediately started crying because of, you know, like, even thinking about it now gets me teary-eyed. Because, like, that was a significant movement where we hear you. You know, we hear our international students, and we want to ensure that you're okay. So that moved the needle from looking at international students from, you know, oh yeah, okay, we're international students because, you know, it moved away from that money thing, and it moved to, I got you. And to this day, I still talk about that, and I still get chills, and I still get teary-eyed about it. So.
And one of the really interesting pieces about that particular policy change by the government was that it cost the government nothing, basically, like, in the grand scheme of things, right? So something that has such a profound impact on individuals, like you've just described, that really has very small financial, like, you know, mm-hmm. repercussions mm-hmm. to the province. Like, it just is a no-brainer. So
exactly. Yeah.
What about some of the other kind of bright lights or successes or things that have really made the experience better for you, more welcoming, made you feel so in love with the city, the province? Like, tell me about the good.
Oh yeah. So for me, it's New Brunswickers. I want to, if I could have my wish, I would like to wave a wand and just, like, give every New Brunswicker a sense of pride of their province. And, like, the sense of pride of what everyone does. Like, I like to talk. And I like to meet new people, and I I've met so many people who are just like super cool people, and it's not even just in St. John. It's all over the province. It's like I have a tendency to, you know, besides just go to a new, like get in my car and drive to some little community, or get in the car and drive to one of the cities, and I just like to speak to people and hear the things that people are doing within the province, and just hearing like the visions and the passion that people have for their province. It's inspiring, and it's how can we connect these individuals who are doing so many cool things, and like that makes me excited. That gives me a sense of like, wow, like, you know, and then people hearing my stories, and you know, we're communicating and we're connecting, and it's conversations like, you know, you're like the first, you know, Black person I met, and like you're a cool person. And it's realizing that, you know, people within our province, you know, we're not seeing diversity, and we're not having the opportunity to connect to people. So when I have the opportunity to connect to someone and change someone's perception of a newcomer, or of someone who's a part of the LGBT community, or, you know, of as an international student, that just makes me smile. And they start to, you know, become allies, and they start to start other conversations with their counterparts. So I feel like that's like a bright light. And I say that New Brunswick is in a renaissance, so I like to be involved with great things. So the potential of the province and the region really excites me as a really bright light. And I always say that the Maritimes is in an exciting time. And yeah, so those things are my bright lights that I'd be like, okay, I'm glad, I'm happy to be here type things.
So do you think when we put this episode out, Tourism New Brunswick will pay us for you being the best promoter of the province ever?
You know what? I'm still trying. Like, please help me. I need a part-time gig.
No, that's so amazing. And I think one of the things you kind of mentioned, and we talked a little bit about it in the first episode we did about inclusive immigration, and that is recognizing the lived experience, not only of newcomers to our province, but of folks who have lived in the province their entire life and haven't had that kind of lived experience that you've referenced, and how important it is for us to get out of our comfort zones. And, you know, whether it's going to some of the like really amazing cultural fairs, or volunteering with the multicultural community, things like that, and just having conversations with newcomers and recognizing exactly what you said, that like, you know, we're all people, and there's a lot that unites us, more that unites us than divides us, because again, like, what divides us? Like, nothing. Bias,
exactly.
Really. That's
exactly
it.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I was at a culture competency training, and one of the things that we talked about, we always say that, you know, the system is broken, the system is broken, the system is broken. However, the presenter was saying, you know, the system's not broken. The system was created to, you know, benefit a select few, or, you know, divide and conquer. Like, the system is operating like it's supposed to operate. What we need to do now is we need to start having conversations to create a new system that benefits all. So it's you know, getting out of our comfort zone. It's having these conversations. It's, you know, it's understanding that you could interact with people, and although, you know, they may be different and they may have a different belief system as you, we need to develop this understanding of respect for one another.
Absolutely. I love that. Let me dig in a little bit more. So you mentioned when describing that you wanted to just broaden and get an education and kind of leave Bermuda for those reasons. And you did identify some other kind of policy lived experience challenges there. But what was it about Canada? Like, how did you end up in St. John, New Brunswick, of all places?
Oh my gosh. It's actually a funny story. So I'm a very strategic person, like, you know, it's, you know, so my thing is, Canada's dollar was lower at the time. So I was like, okay, I'm going to Canada. And then I Googled of like affordable places to live in Canada, and then New Brunswick came up. And then there was like a career fair that happened at my high school at the time. And so a little background. Bermuda loves Nova Scotia. Growing up, I did not know that, Canada had all these other provinces. It was either Nova Scotia and like in particular Halifax and then Toronto. I did not know that there was like other little other not other little but other provinces within the country. So, and that happened because the Nova Scotia universities have like a strong connection with the university with a strong connection with the island. So this poor not poor but like this little New Brunswick section came up, and then you had all the universities there, and they were trying so hard to, say, oh, come to New Brunswick. New Brunswick's fun. And then the recruiter for UNB, who no longer works for UNB, so UNB don't get upset. She was not interested in her job. She was just like, okay, so we have two campuses. One campus is in like a big city, but it's small. One campus is in a small city, and it's big. Here's a pamphlet. And she was not interested in having a conversation with me about coming to UNB. And that enticed me. I don't know why it enticed me, but it enticed me. And I started looking up the university. I started looking at St. John. And then, like, I flew in, and then we're here now.
Wow,
So
no, that's so interesting.
And it was just like a fluke. Like looking back at it, I was like, I don't understand why. Maybe it was fate. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everything happens for a reason. Amazing. And so when you did come to New Brunswick and come to UNB and St. John, you fairly quickly got involved in both the campus and broadly the community. Like when you would have, you were pro were you in your second or third year during your time with the student union or
Oh,
both?
that was my first year. I, you know,
That was your
orientation ha
first year?
orientation
Amazing.
came in. I was just like, okay, I see what's happening here. Let me just get involved with this real quick.
Oh my gosh.
I became an executive for my second year.
Amazing. So, yeah, tell me a bit more about like why that was so important to you and what experience you gained from taking on those roles right away and getting involved in the community right away.
So at first it started as a survival tactic. I knew I wanted to get my permanent residence. So I recently, as I said, I recently came out. There was like a few protests, a few protests happening in the island surrounding same-sex marriage. So like I was scared. I did not want to move back home to be able. I didn't want to move back home and suppress myself, and become a person who I wasn't. So I turned into a survival mode. I had to get involved. I had to like meet people because I wanted people to know who I am. So when I graduated, it was easier to get a job. So it was very like person. It was person. Like I was looking internally at first. However, the more I got involved, the more I realized that I was like the only person of color sitting at most of the tables, and like things were happening, and then I was cringing. I was just like, no, this is not how we're supposed to do things. And then it just moved to a point where I had to be at these tables. I had to get involved because no one else was doing it. At the time, like the international community was tired. Students were tired. They knew that the running idea international students had was, we're cash cows. The only reason why university students want us here is because we're paying more tuition, and it's easy money. Like you can hike up international students' tuition, and you won't have an uprise. You won't have a cry. So international students had this perception. So like they had given up, and so I saw that, and I was just like, no, this is not right. So like my involvement then moved to being, changing the narrative and, getting people talking and getting people talking about, our newcomers. And then I just want to, provide opportunity for other people who look like me. I wanted to be able to make mistakes. I wanted to be able to, open doors and allow other people to come in, and it's happening. I look at the I was a part of the UMB Students Representative Council. I have seen so many more international students want to get involved with the council now, and I'm not saying it was because of me, but they now see like, okay, you know, I could be involved with this. You're seeing more international students, you know, want to get involved with the Greater St. John community, and it's a beautiful thing to see people do this, and it's people coming back to me and being like, you know, you remember when you told me like stop complaining and get involved? Like, yeah, I actually did it now. So it's stuff like that really motivated me to continue to get involved, and to this day, it's, you know, I still try to do it.
I think it's so important, like, that you highlight again some of those key barriers, and I'd like to talk a little bit about some, I guess, policy broadly that is kind of hindering inclusion or that could be tweaked to support inclusion. And I actually think of when I was president of the student union, so I talk a lot about the fact that in the last 10 years, actually it's now probably more, at UNB Fredericton, I have been the only president who's been a woman. But one of the, you know, of course, bright lights there is that I think two of the four presidents since me have been, Herb was an international student, and then, and then the following year, Richard, right? So that's a positive. But one of the things that happened during my time at council, so in Fredericton, at UMB Fredericton, the role of president is a full-time position. And because of that, the bylaws stated that the president could only take up to two courses. However, as you'll know, as an international student, if you can't take only two courses, right? Like, you have to be a full-time student. Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. So correct, that immediately removed any international student from the running of president. And it's, again, like one of those things that nobody ever thought about because that issue didn't face the council at the time. And so we didn't actually have the opportunity to amend those. It was brought up kind of too late in our mandate, and we didn't have enough council sittings to amend the bylaws. But the following year, they did, which is great. But it's, again, those small things that at face value you don't think have any impact, but it just excludes a whole portion of the population.
So talk to me about
some more kind of inclusionary based policy. And it, you know, doesn't obviously have to be at student union level. It can be if that's top of mind, but just broadly.
Yeah. So I feel like the big one is student visa requirements. For example, when I was a student, I was working close to 65 hours during the summer because I couldn't work during my term. I had to figure out a way of how can I, you know, still be involved with all of like my advocacy work in New Brunswick and still be a student. And I had to make some sacrifices for all of the 4 years of my university. I did not go home because I had to make that decision. I was like, am I going to hinder helping my fellow international students to go home and you know, make more, either potentially make more money home, or am I gonna, you know, have to sit here, not sit here, I have to, you know, stay within the province and, you know, work all these jobs and you know, literally stress myself out just for the work that I want to ensure that will happen. And, you know, international students have to make this decision. It's and you look at, you know, for example, nursing students, where you have to do clinicals, and they have to make these decisions because, you know, they have clinicals during the year, and they have to work during the summer. Or with students with co-op opportunities in the business faculties, we're setting up our international students for, you know, basically failure, and it's kind of contradictory. You know, we're saying come to New Brunswick, come to Canada, we're welcoming, yet when they get here, we're not creating policies that encourage retention. You're creating policies that, you know, is one-sided, and then it goes into that narrative where all of the policies, basically in reference to, you know, recruitment of international students, is geared basically on economic drivers. And then it's, you know, and then it goes into that, goes into psyches where I'm not a person. I'm here as money. You're basically, my name is no longer KJ. You just want to call me by my bank account. So it's like policies like that is having the understanding that these students are students. They're going through the same problems as our domestic students, but is amplified because no one wants to have that conversation and no one wants to talk to them because at the end of the day, they're, and I'm doing air quotes right now, they're not Canadian, or they really don't contribute to the tax base. When actuality, international students are contributing to society, they are contributing to our tax base. So we should be, you know, ensuring that they have opportunities to work during their school year, as like, you know, everyone else is. So I like that one is a big problem in reference to international students and retention.
Well, and I think it goes back to what we've talked a lot about already in the episode, which is, you know, creating a sense of community for international students that could be amplified even just by them working through the school year because they're getting involved with the community in a different way, and just meeting new folks and feeling a bit more connected. So I think also you raise a very interesting point. I think, you know, obviously in New Brunswick and more broadly in Canada, we're talking a lot about immigration, but it is very much from the perspective of like, oh, we have an aging workforce. This many people are going to be leaving the job market and we need people to fill those positions. And, you know, New Brunswickers or Canadians, they're not having babies. And so therefore we need immigration. And the only, like, the line connecting is literally like, oh, we're going to have jobs opening up. We need immigration, rather than like, you know, we can create better, inclusive, more diverse communities for everybody. And so I think that's just such an important, like, we have to switch the narrative. But again, back to international students, like, once you get the, okay, we need immigration, which is, again, 100% true. I'm not going to argue with the economic argument, because that's literally all we hear, right? But but then it's, okay, so international students, great, they're already here, they've got experience, they're educated in our universities, perfect. They're the perfect folks to integrate into the workforce. But everything you just said shows all of the barriers that we're creating for international students to be able to do that if they so choose, right? Like, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that that's such a bang-on example. Like, if this is as important as we say it is, then why aren't we treating international students like humans and treating them like, you know,
exactly
like what we, the, yeah, like, why aren't we creating those policies and why aren't we being more open to those policies? So
yeah, it's and that's like a conversation I always have. It's, we have international students who have basically immersed themselves within our communities. They either have friends, they have families now, they have, you know, life partners, and they have integrated in a way that is organic. We always look at recruitment and retention as such a rigid, policy-driven initiative, when genuine and sustainable retention happens organically, and it doesn't happen in the span of an election term, or it doesn't happen in the span of 4 years. You know, and we need to start having these conversations where we need to move away from like putting a timeline on the retention aspect of things. Because, you know, I'll use my example again, is when I moved here, I was like, okay, yeah, I do like living here, but, like, you know, I had the opportunity to be, you know, traveling to Ottawa a lot. So I was like, Ottawa is where it's at. Like, you know, this is where all the policy hungry people go. And, you know, once I graduated, I just stopped looking for jobs outside of the province. I turned down jobs outside of the province because I was like, I need to stay here because I have family here. Like, I've fully immersed myself here, and I don't want to uproot my life now and move somewhere else. And that happened because I had the opportunity to, you know, step out of my comfort zone, and not everyone has that opportunity, or not a lot of people are like that, to, you know, step out of the comfort zone. But I in the total of my 4 years at UMB, I knew at least 30 international students who left. And one of the main reasons why they left is that they didn't feel like they have a sense of community. They were tired of being looked at as, you know, a cash cow. They were they experienced racism, they experienced xenophobia. They were not provided with the opportunity to be their authentic self, and they left because they were pushed out. Those are 30 individuals that could have been staying within our province and contributing. So when we look at policies, I mean, when we look at initiatives, every initiative I see doesn't have a sense of organic, people-driven framework. And, you know, that's why I'm going to give a little shout out to New Lab, for example. You know, the Economic Immigration Lab is a beautiful example of how you could, you know, bring government at the table through PEDAL. You have the private sector there, and then you have immigrants there, and you're having that collaboration to build policies and create initiatives that, you know, build empathy around newcomers to ensure that they stay in their terms. So it's more things like, you know, the Economic Immigration Lab and having these conversations is, you know, that way of, you know, having that organic retention.
And just building off that point, so there is an interesting jurisdictional issue as well within immigration, mm-hmm. right? Because the federal mm-hmm. government is the one responsible for most of the policies relating to immigration. But exactly, again, yeah. all newcomers, they live in Canada, but they live in provinces. And so
exactly.
That I think is such an interesting dichotomy. And so, you know, even though folks are having this dialogue at the New Brunswick level, how does that conversation reach the federal government? And I actually think the federal government has really started to ramp up some mm-hmm. changes that mm-hmm. have been positive. One of them, I think this one was actually a few years back now, they did change, and you would obviously, I'm sure, know more about this, the residency requirement to become a permanent resident for international students. Is that correct? Like they count the years that you're at school now, and that wasn't the case?
Yeah, that's correct. So they have like a tally system that adds up to your to getting your permanent residence. And, you know, if you go to a public university, that point, like, you know, that's on the same level of, you know, being bilingual. So it's, you know, you are seeing, you know, initiatives there. However, to get your permanent residency, that's not a thing that, for example, I can't get my permanent residency now because I financially cannot afford it. So it's that one thing where it's like, oh, great. Like, you know, once I get to the step of, you know, getting my permanent residency, I know I'm going to get it because I have so many extra points. However, I don't have the funds because I was a student. So everyone has some form of student debt. I don't have the funds to pay close to $2,000 to obtain my permanent residency. You know, under the process now, I come from a British colony. I'm from, like, English is my first language. However, I have to pay close to $300 to take a test to prove that I speak English, even though I went to a accredited English-speaking university. I wouldn't be able to have my degree if I wasn't able to read the same requirements as this test I have to take. So it's things like this where we're creating Band-Aid solutions for a larger problem.
It's a good thing my microphone was on mute there, because when you said it is $2,000, I literally was like, what? Like, yeah. So it costs $2,000 to get your permanent residency?
Yeah, so like all of the fees, so there's like $1,000.
Yeah, right, sure, so like, everything so
like,
combined.
Yeah, everything combined is like close to like $2,000.
Oh my gosh, yeah, and like as you mentioned, not even just as an international student, but like I don't know many early 20-somethings that could afford to drop $2,000 on anything. Like, I certainly couldn't have. So this has been such a fantastic conversation. And one of the questions I did ask in our first episode, I asked Jeanette, how can folks like me or folks listening to this episode promote a more constructive dialogue around immigration, particularly in this current time and space when, unfortunately, both across our country and some of our close friends are talking about immigration in a way that is not the most constructive?
Mm-hmm. I would say prepare to get uncomfortable and be okay with being uncomfortable. I have this like ongoing joke that we always talk about diversity and inclusion, but we never talk about how can we get there. And what we fail to realize is that we live in a world where everyone has different life experiences and different opinions. And when you have so much diversity, you're going to have, you're going to have some bumps. And so like my thing is be able to prepare to have that bumps. And if you have that curiosity in mind and you're willing to learn and you're willing to be able to fail, that is the thing that you need to have. Like, you know, I always say like failing forward is the way to go. And I also have that approach when it comes to immigration, because, you know, although I am a newcomer, I have to interact with other fellow newcomers who have different culture backgrounds and different beliefs that are different from mine. So like I also have that learning and that, you know, that failing forward approach that needs to happen. And what we need to do is start having conversations. We need to start talking with our friend groups about this, about immigration. We need to start becoming allies, because there's no allies when it comes to newcomers and when it comes to this conversation. So we need to be able to prepare to meet someone new. I know that throughout the major cities, there are living libraries. And, you know, a living library is basically, you, instead of taking out a book, you listen to someone's story and you listen to a newcomer's story. And when I participate in one, I just learned so much and I have a new perspective of like the different types of segments within the newcomer community. So it's, you know, it's volunteering at these culture festivals. It's going to living libraries. It's stepping out of your comfort zone. It's, you know, it's getting involved and being a part of that conversation. So it's podcasts like this. It's, you know, it's bringing immigration to the forefront, and it's developing empathy across the board. If that's like my main. If anyone listening to this podcast is developing empathy for one another and developing empathy for newcomers is the way to promote a effective, you know, dialogue.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think one of the things you mentioned that is so important is recognizing that not all newcomers are the same and they all have their own lived experience. And the intersectionality piece you mentioned earlier in the episode is so critical, right? Every single person has a different lived experience, whether newcomer or not. And we need to ensure that we're not continuing with blanket policies that support a few people and really hinder or oppress a whole lot more. Like, we have to be doing things differently. And that does mean maybe it's a bit harder and maybe things take a bit longer. But at the end, all folks are going to be better off because of that. And I think we need to give the space to policymakers to be able to, well, not only the space to policymakers, but I think you're right in the sense that we need to engage with policymakers and help move folks along and support that. Amazing. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I feel like I learned a lot just from this dialogue, and it was really engaging for me. I feel energized after this discussion. And thank you so much for being a friend of the pod and supporting us right from the beginning.
Yes, I will forever be, I'll forever be a supporter. I love podcasts. I love when people talk about policy and like make it like and break it down to make an understanding. We just need more people making policy sexy. We need to like have these conversations. So thank you for doing your due diligence to, you know, provide that space and, you know, plant that seed of curiosity.
Thank you. This has been amazing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks again for tuning in. You can follow along with FemWonk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FemWonk. And if you loved this episode, please feel free to leave us a review, and don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.